tried to emphasize when he said it's a horrible condition when fathers bury sons and not sons' father. Or Solon, the lyric poet, said, "War hunts out young men, spies them and grabs them." They hated war, but they accepted the ubiquity of it. That's why when we look in Greek history or classical history or European history, we have this bad habit of First and Second Peloponnesian Wars, First, Second, Third Punic Wars, First, Second, Third Sacred Wars, the First, Second, Third Macedonian Wars. Almost like 30 Years' War, 100 Years' War, 7 Years' War, World War I, World War II. And then if we go to places, it's not just the Battle of Mantinea, it's the First Battle of Mantinea, Second Battle of Mantinea, Third Battle of Mantinea. If we could all be airlifted to classical Thebes, I think I could take you within 40 minutes to 9 great battlefields. Chaeronea, where the Greek city-states lost their freedom. Plataea, where they won it. Delium, Oinophyta, Haliartus, Tegira, I could go on and on. They're all within a little place, a little valley. It's what Epaminondas, the great liberator, called the dancing floor of war. So there's this presumption that war is tragic, but it's with us. Very different from the 1986 declaration by the UN Special Committee on War that said that declared war unnatural and did not have to occur again. The Greeks were more interested in accepting it and then finding ways to deal with it so that it, because it was a tragic occurrence, it would lessen the wounded and the dead and the cost of war. So they were interested in what causes wars. And this is, again, a world of pre-Marx. They didn't believe that economic exploitation or necessarily material grievances led wars to break out. If you look at Athens in the 5th century, they were at war 3 out of every 4 years. One time, I counted all of the wars in Herodotus, Thucydides, and Xenophon that I could find to see what caused them. And 75% of them were over borderland. Now you think, well, that makes sense because war is supposed to, as Aristotle said, acquisition. But the borderland was almost worthless. The land between Argos and Sparta or Thebes and Athens is worthless, but it was very valuable for matters of status, prestige, honor. In fact, those are the three things that Thucydides, he says, self-interest, honor, and fear are why the Athenians go to war. If you think of this a minute, it makes sense. I don't think the British people needed the Falklands in 1981. I know the Argentines didn't need the Malvinas, but it was symbolic because a dictatorship was losing popular appeal in Argentina and took those islands, probably because the British had withdrawn a small little ship and they thought they did not have deterrence. And the British government couldn't live with the idea that a second-rate power with impunity could attack British sovereignty. As Borges said about the island itself, it's like two bald men fighting over a comb. It had no real value, but it did have value in a certain way. And if you look at antiquity, where we have such empirical people like Herodotus and Polybius and Caesar who look at these wars, they tell us that symbolic capital is very important. I can just add, I don't really think that the Middle East war is just over the occupied West Bank. It's far more than that. It's the occupied West Bank as a symbol. And we can talk about what I think it's over, if you like, in question. So wars in this pre-Marxist idea don't really come out of poverty necessarily or exploitation. I live in an area in California where some of the poorest people on the planet are coming up to live next to us, Mary and my family from Oaxaca and Jalisco. They're not blowing up planes. They really aren't. If you look at the profile of some of the 9/11, Hezbollah, Hamas, they're not from the sewers of Cairo. A lot of them are educated and affluent. It's almost as the more appetites they develop for Western culture, the faster the appetite grows, the less Islam can repress, and that creates a frustration. And it involves things like lucidity and honor and status and fear. Why do wars break out? Just because people have disagreements. Athens had a disagreement with Sparta, as I was just talking to Mimi, for 50 years. Why did they go to war in 431? Well, it wasn't just Vegetus who said, he who wants peace, prepare for war. It was actually an obscure Theban general named Pagondas in the fourth book of Thucydides' history when he said, the Athenians have come into our territory and they've ravaged our plain and they've gone back now. But we still have to fight them, even though they're right on the border. And everybody said, well, they're gone. Don't do this. He said, no, we have to adopt the idea of preemption. We have to defeat them so badly that they'll never do it again. So he convinces the other 11 generals. They vote. They fight the Battle of Delium. They win. And for the next 150 years, Athens doesn't set foot into Delium. And the ancient idea then, what prevents wars is that one side feels that the costs are too great to go to war because of their perceived grievances. Grievances don't have to be real, after all. It, as I said, it involves status or fear. But people will go to war when they feel that war does not contain enough punishment or does not contain enough risk to satisfy these other, sometimes quite illogical, desires and appetites. For example, I really do think that, I don't want to gang up on our poor ambassador to Iraq in 1991, but I do think the idea that Saddam Hussein could go into Kuwait without repercussions may have helped that war to start, in the same way that the British had given the idea that there would be a solution to the Malvinas, Falklands that would not necessarily involve war. Same thing with the North Korean problem. I don't know if this sounds saber-rattling or not, but I do think that something happened to Israel when the 39 Scuds were sent in during the first Gulf War, then the unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon, and then the 96% of the West Bank offer. I'm not interested in the tangible issues involved, just simply that sent a message that a new generation of Israelis either would not or could not fight in the same preemptory manner. And I think it was catastrophic because it helped send the wrong message to people who thought this intifada would work a lot more than it did. So deterrence is very important, and that seems to be, in the classical mind, what prevents wars. Why did the Spartans invade in May 431 and not 436 or 450? It's because people in Sparta had grown up 50 years since the Persian Wars. There was no generation that had any goodwill with the Athenians, and more importantly, in 446, they had gone into Attica, and the Athenians had not stopped them and had begged them to get back out. And the generation had thought, you see, we can go up there anytime we want and they won't do anything. Well, it was catastrophic because the Athenians would do something, but they had sent the wrong message prior. Of course, nothing is worse sending a strong message and not backing it up, as we see throughout other examples. When war breaks out, then who wins? Well, that would be arrogant to suggest that anybody could survey 2,500 years and get some rigid principle. But I would say that there's something about the West, I know that's controversy as well, but there's something about the West, and I mean the culture that starts in Greece, spreads through Macedon, goes into Rome, survives the collapse of the empire, projects military power when it's wrought and divided by Orthodoxy, Protestantism, and Catholicism. There's something about Europe that's not explicable to just its small population and territory. It has an ability to project military power beyond what, by any other measure, it should not. Now, the usual criteria in a battle that determine why one side wins and one side loses are known to everybody. They're culturally, they don't regard culture, that is, numbers. Your army is bigger than the other person. Logistics, that's better supply. Distance, you're fighting at home and they're fighting 7,000 miles away. Personal courage, that's not culturally specific. Brilliance, if you have a Hannibal, or as Wellington said of Napoleon, he's worth 40,000 men. All of those can determine who wins and who loses. That might determine why the U.S. Cavalry loses at Little Bighorn, or why the Battle of Isla Wanda in 1879, Lord Chelmsford loses that first battle. But that being said, there are other more ultimate criteria that tend to trump those and that give Western powers the ability to colonize, say, North or South America or Africa or Asia. Depends why Cortez is in Tenochtitlan and Montezuma is not in Barcelona, or why the British Army can conquer Zululand, the most formidable African tribesmen in the arts of war. They can do it in about 9 months. And I think that involves things like the commitment to a secular society where philosophical and scientific research is not deeply embedded as it is sometimes in Chinese history, in religion or philosophy. I'm always reminded, you get the Sun Tzu and you put it down on your left side, and then you put Aeneas Tacitus on your right side, two military manuals written exactly the same time, probably in the 4th century. The Sun Tzu is much more exciting, it's much more fascinating, it's brilliantly written, but it talks within the first three pages about the yin and the yang and the hot and the cold. And you pick up Aeneas Tacitus, and it's, if you want to take a city, you go over, through, or under. And it's very Western because it's disconnected from politics and philosophy and religion. It's amoral, in other words, and that's given Westerners an enormous advantage. It means if they steal things like gunpowder, they have the ability to employ capitalism or open markets or rival interpretations of how to develop it. And so they're exporting guns back into China. Westerners have a greater degree of personal freedom and individualism, and that's valuable too. It doesn't mean that everybody in the Middle Ages is under democracy, but the ideas of classical freedom do not die, and that even in so-called authoritarian regimes in Europe, there's never the degree of personal coercion that there is in the East. That's why even when Cortez is fighting Montezuma, the Hidalgos come up to him and his fellow conquistadors argue with him. In fact, he served a legal summons. Somebody in this, you lawyers must enjoy that. Right when he's going to take Tenochtitlan, Mr. Navarez comes up and says, I've got a summons to have you appear before the king. Well, nobody would even think of that. And if we had time to talk, that gives armies this challenge and response advantages. Western armies are also subject to civic critique. As we speak, people are critiquing our war plans. The Iraqis are not. I can't think of one Greek general over 300 years from any city-state that at one time was not fined, exiled, or executed, or had his property confiscated. Pericles fined, Lysander exiled, Pausanias exiled, Epaminondas, greatest general, conquers all of the Peloponnese, and then he's put on trial for his life. That suggests that this idea of civic involvement and audit of military operations, as bothersome as it is a deeply ingrained Western idea. We could go on, but I would say just the scientific tradition, when it's married with capitalism, not only is able to steal individual genius from different places, but to find a mechanism to disseminate that thought. Among classicists, especially in the last 2 years, I've been reading, well, the Arab world kept alive classical texts. I don't think that you could make the argument that the key classical texts of Aristotle, for example, were kept alive in the Arab world. But if you made the argument that some were, which they were, what's fascinating is there's almost no level of dissemination as you see in the West. In other words, people are Mandarin-like as keepers of knowledge, but it's very hard to disseminate it because it always runs up, whether it's banking or lighthouse construction about the supremacy of Allah in a way that the Catholic Church is never able quite to achieve. Not that it wouldn't like to, but it's fighting against this classical tradition of secularism. How do wars end? Well, I could just tip my hand a little bit by saying in Livy and Tacitus, Cicero, we have this term in Latin, bellum interruptum, which we call peace. The ancients didn't. They just called it an interrupted war. And by that I mean, if we survey wars through the history, it's very depressing. I don't like it to be true because it almost suggests that wars don't end until the reason that they broke out is gone, whether it's a perceived reason or it's a real grievance. Sparta fought Athens for 27 years, but given what both sides wanted to accomplish, that war would only end when there was Athenians sitting on the Spartan Acropolis or there were Spartans sitting on the Athenian Acropolis. And it ended when Spartans were sitting on the Athenian Acropolis and tore down the long walls. Even though there was something called the Peace of Nicias, which from 421 to 415 was a bellum interruptum, but that didn't solve any of the issues involved. So what do these interrupted pieces do? They give each side a chance to catch their breath and adopt new strategies to go back at it. And with classic examples, the First, Second, Third Punic War. The Third Punic War is a brutal war, but that's the end of the Carthage-Roman rivalry. If we were to project this even on the modern scene, it would be very, I think, sobering. You could almost make the argument that World War I was not resolved because the German army did not surrender in Germany. Surrendered in Belgium and France. Now, it might have cost 1 million men, as Wilson told Pershing, to go all the way to Berlin. But Pershing knew something. He said that the German army is not defeated. It's beaten on the field of battle tactically. But this is the first time in 4 years we've got 1 million people coming in from America, another 1 million after the 1 million that were there. And we have the ability to teach the German army that it's a very dangerous thing to leave its borders. And it didn't do that. And we had peace for our generation, Versailles peace, and we did the worst thing you could do, and that's impose a rather harsh peace on an enemy that doesn't feel that it's defeated. And the German army went back to the praise of the Weimar people and said, we never lost, the Jews and the communists stabbed us in the back. And we had World War II, and that mistake was not repeated. And if you read what Mr. Roosevelt and Churchill's advisors were writing about World War II, they were always writing in echoes of what had gone wrong in World War I. In that context, I think the greatest military blunder since the Gulf War, since Vietnam, was the failure to go to Baghdad, because we didn't understand the purpose. The purpose wasn't just to get him out of Kuwait, it was to get a person who would dare to go into Kuwait out. Because given the nature of American society and democracies in general, it's very hard to mobilize public support to finally go 7,000 miles on the other side of the world and then to simply getting back inside his borders when that wasn't the problem. He could go into Saudi Arabia, he could send missiles to Israel, he could do any of these things. Because he, not Kuwait, was the problem, which should remind us that the weapons of mass destruction are not the problem. That's not why Russia has weapons of mass destruction. They're no longer a problem with us as they were in the Cold War. The problem is who has them. And so that's the problem. That's how wars have to end, one side or the other. I was struck by the president's axis of evil, who was in it and who wasn't. Vietnam wasn't in it. I can make the argument, I think if I had time, we won that war militarily in a tactical sense, but there's no question we lost it. And so we were defeated and withdrew, and the issue of the difference, that is, the difference, America thought that it could enforce non-communist rule throughout Southeast Asia, was settled. We decided we could not do that, because Cambodia and Vietnam occurred. So it's not an axis of evil. That's been settled. Germany wasn't in the axis of evil. Neither was Japan. That's been settled. The idea that both those countries could adopt militarism and challenge liberal democracies is over with, at least for our generation. I think for good. But who is in there? Well, in some ways, Iran and us have been in sort of a quiet struggle since 1979. Once that rule was set that you could invade sovereign American property and take hostages and then get concessions to have them freed, that started a terrible precedent. And I think maybe Daniel Pipes will correct me, but maybe before 9/11, more Americans had been killed by Hezbollah than any other terrorist group. So they're in the axis of evil because that's never been resolved. This disagreement with Iraq will continue to fester until there's either a revolution in Iran, or that we decide that we can't do anything and withdraw from the Middle East. Iraq was in the axis of evil. We just talked about that. We didn't eliminate that problem. And North Korea is a classic bellum interruptum. For whatever reason, we don't have to refight the Korean War, but there was never the sense that the North Koreans had lost the war strategically. I think you could make the argument by 1951 that the North Korean army was beaten, as was the Chinese army. Remember, American artillery and B-29s inflicted over 1 million casualties on the Chinese army alone. But that war was never. Wrapping up then, it would mean, I don't want to put words in all of our mouths, but it seems to me that what happened to us on 9/11, if I could use this classical paradigm and just summarize previous points, that the Muslim world is not at war with us necessarily because there's Americans in the holy shrines, or as they say, women are walking around with bare sleeves in Mecca, which is a lie. I've read that. And it's not because we did anything to Muslims. This argument's been made about who helped save Bosnia, who saved some Muslims in Kosovo. We helped the Somalis. We helped the first Afghans. We saved the Kuwaitis. I got a call from the Kuwaiti ambassador once, or his attaché, angry that I'd written something. And he said, well, you don't understand. It's the Palestinian issue. I said, well, you ethnically cleansed 300,000 Palestinians after we liberated your country. So why can you be mad at us about the Palestinian issue? But it's not that. It's a matter of pride, lucidity, and honor and status, because whether we like it or not, Western culture is intrusive, it's crass, it's dynamic, and it offers people something that they want. And it's appealing to people in the Middle East faster than the mullahs can repress it, faster than the patriarch at the table can stop it, faster than males can say no to women, faster than dictators can say no to enslaved subjects. And it's a volatile, dynamic idea, and it creates a variety of mixed emotions, which we saw come out on 9/11. But just because there's those emotions, it doesn't mean they have to break out. But they broke out, I think, because I think the key point was 1979 with the Iranian hostage taking. And then the destruction of not just the Marine barracks, but the embassy and its annex in Lebanon, as well as the embassy bombings in Europe, the First World Trade Center, Khobar Towers, USS Cole. Again, the response was predictable, either a stern lecture and a cruise missile or two, and then nothing, and sort of containment. We put them in a box and make their heads stop. Their way of thinking, much different. Deterrence is not what you think, it's what the enemy thinks. And if you read what Osama bin Laden said, not what we said he said, he didn't think there was any deterrence. Then when the war broke out, it seems to me that it was a classic example of a Western war versus a non-West. One of the most disturbing things in my life was to read what people were writing on October 1st about Afghanistan. The peaks are too high, it's too cold, it's Ramadan. The 1973 war was called the Ramadan War. The Russians, the graveyard of the Russians, graveyard of the British, we went, and a lot of us thought it would be, and wrote that it would be over 6 weeks, because only the United States and people who follow that Western paradigm would have the ability to project military power 6,000 miles away, have computer nerds on computers, have generals arguing with each other, have technology that would find the ultimate expression not through religion or through fears of social chaos, but just the law of market and military efficacy. And so it's pretty clear to me that what happened in Afghanistan will happen also in Iraq. And then how will the war end? The war, it seems to me, is started on 9/11. And we had that first war called the 9/11 War, and then we had the second war, it's an ongoing war against terrorism, which is basically surveillance and counterterrorism in cities of the West. Then we had the third branch called the Taliban War, and now we have the fourth, the Iraqi theater. So it reminds me so much, I think I wrote that not long ago, of what Thucydides was confronted with. There was the Paphian War, the Ionian War, the Decelean War, the Sicilian War. They involved Athens versus Sicily, Athens versus Sparta, Athens versus Thebes. There was counterinsurgency in Corcyra. There was traditional hoplite battles. There was 21 sieges. There was six nations. But the whole point, and what made Thucydides a genius, he alone said, it's a war against radical Athenian democracy and its reach. And that's what his unifying theme was. And I think that's the unifying theme today. How will it end? I think, unlike people, I don't believe it's going to go on for a decade. I think as we are speaking, there's going to be less and less terrorist manifestations. And we've eliminated a large sanctuary in Afghanistan. I think the same was going to be true in Iraq. There's no accident why Mr. Abu Nadal and Abu Abbas and Al-Qaeda people are in Kurdistan. there's a reason for that, and when he's gone, there will be no more reason. And finally, why do we find all of this so objectionable in our own society? And that's something I've spent a lot of my life trying to figure out. If the Greeks were such an empirical people and thought that to understand war in this Thucydidean or realistic fashion did not denote support for it, or didn't mean that you were culturally pessimistic, or it didn't mean that you were morally inferior, that you accepted the brutality. Well, why do we? Is it Christianity? Sermon on the Mount? People have made that argument, especially Gibbon. I'm not sure that, because there was a doctrine called jus in bello that developed that you could fight wars. Is it the classical Roman exegesis is a little closer, what Juvenal and Suetonius called luxus, the combination of a consumer lifestyle, suburban lifestyle, affluence, leisure, what the ancients call license, that suggested that as products of the Enlightenment, we were either too smart, or we were too clever, or we could out-talk somebody. We didn't believe that anybody would be so silly or so illogical to do what they did. That's an arrogance, and it reminds me what the Greeks always taught, the non-Socratic Greeks, the pre-Socratics, that with moral, that with intellectual progress can come moral regress. Moral regress. Socrates tried to stop that, but there was two centuries prior to him that made that argument. And it seems to me that this is really a classical test of Western culture to prove that wrong, that people can enjoy liberal democracy, open markets, the chauvinism of a middle class, they can enjoy consumer culture, but they still have to believe that their culture means something and it's unique and it's worth fighting for. Because like Romans, if we don't believe that anymore, then we'll come to a close. I'll end with a final thought that debating someone from Harvard not long ago in NPR, he said, well, we're just like the Romans. We've taken on all of these enemies in the 4th century, and now we're going to fall because of our arrogance. I said, Rome had more enemies in the 2nd century B.C., and they didn't have anybody in the 4th century A.D. like they did in the 2nd. Philip V and Hannibal at the same time. They lost 600 men a minute at Cannae. And after the battles of Trasimene, Trebia, and Cannae, they'd lost 120,000 in the small. But the difference was, in 200 B.C., they knew what it was to be Roman, and it was better than the alternative. And by 400 A.D., they surely did not. And that seems to me the only question that's out on the table. It's not whether they're going to defeat us, it's whether we think our culture is different and better and worth defending. Not perfect, but better than the alternative. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the tour de force. Wonderful indeed. I'm flattered that you think we all know our ancient history as well as you seem to think we do. And what I'd like to focus on to begin with is, first, I not surprisingly broadly agree with almost everything you say, with one exception. You're saying that we've never had the personal coercion that the Orient has seen. I think we invented totalitarianism of a form that goes beyond anything the Orient has ever devised. But to get to your very key notion of winning in war, the bellum and interruption, I'd like to give you what I'm saying and have you respond to it. And I'm saying this in two contexts. I'm looking at two wars, our war against terror and the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I'm saying that in both cases, what you have is a Western side that is overwhelmingly more powerful in conventional terms, whether one talks about the arsenal or the economy. The issue is not who is stronger in a traditional sense of, you know, two armies clashing, and the one that has got more resources is going to win. But rather, it is a matter of understanding that we are at war. It is almost startling to argue that we are in a war. I mean, there is a reluctance of Americans to believe we're in a war. It doesn't feel like it. I mean, the other side doesn't have, as the Soviet Union did, 200-300 million people. It doesn't have an air force. It doesn't have of intelligence forces. It has box cutters, and it has fleeing elusive terrorists. It doesn't feel like war. And same thing in the Arab-Israeli theater, where the Israelis predominate over the Palestinians. And it is hard for them to understand that this is a war. It is not just an attempt by the Palestinians to improve their stance in negotiating, their standing in the negotiating in the negotiations, but it is rather an attempt to defeat Israel, to destroy Israel. And in our case, what we're facing is an enemy that's not trying to push us out of the Middle East or trying to get a better deal in the oil market, but an enemy that wants to destroy us, that wants to change the fundamentals of our existence. And getting that idea across seems to be very hard. And so long as it's very hard to get across, we can't win.
I would agree with that. I would just say to add, or maybe to nuance that a little bit, of the Israeli, if you look at 1947, 56, 67, 73, 82, there is a pattern of a bellum interruptum. And I don't want to put all of those lump them in, but it seems to me that you could make the argument by day four or day five, the Israelis were winning, and then the Soviet Union stepped in and told us to stop them. And we did, and the reason for that war, that is, the desire to destroy Israel, because the first three wars weren't about the West Bank, was not resolved because they did not get the message that trying to destroy Israel would bring back a retaliation so terrible that you would never want to do it. That being said, now you don't have a Soviet Union. It seems to me that there's a reason you haven't had a conventional war since 82. Because as long as you had the Soviet Union, the Arabs could have a conventional war and then say, time out, United States, stop Israel, or Russia's going to get you. I think that's part of what we see, this breakneck speed in the Middle East to find weapons of mass destruction. In some ways, it's a desperate effort, a race to find a surrogate Soviet Union. For somebody to have a bomb or somebody to have weapons of mass destruction, people haven't talked about that. But I think the idea is that if we, in the Arab world, get this, then we can go back to this passive-aggressive conventional war, and then when we get in a bad strait, we can call in the bomb or something. But it seems to me that since 82, they have not had the Soviet Union, they haven't had the deterrence, and that's why they don't dare attack Israel in the conventional sense.
How about alternative reading, which is that the Israeli, that there are three levels of warfare. There's the conventional, which is tanks and planes and aircraft. There's what the military calls low intensity warfare, which is terrorism. And then there's the weapons of mass destruction. The alternative reading is that the Israelis so dominate the conventional warfare that their enemies have no choice but to go up and down. They've, with the exception of Egypt, essentially forfeited that whole area and said, okay, you've got the tanks, you've got the aircraft, you've got the planes. We can't contest you there, with the exception of Egypt, and we will try these other two, which is in fact what they're doing.
Except, I think that's true, but I think if you look at the 67 war or the 73 war, especially the 73 war, after what Israel had done in the 67 war, there was nobody believed the Egyptians had a chance. Egypt has, as I understand it, 650 Abrams 1A tanks, our best tank they have. And still, if you look at the aggregate air force and conventional weapons, they have enough, I think, firepower that they could give Israel trouble for one or two or three days, just like as they did in the past, and then ask for political concessions. But the reason that they don't do that is that they know that by day four or five or six, they're going to be obliterated, and this time nobody's going to stop them. And anyway.
Good. Open the floor.
I want to talk about another possibility, and that is if you really look at civilization, barbarians. And barbarians have always found the underbelly and the weakness in the civilized force. And when I call barbarians, are the people who live right next to civilization. We have something like Attila the Hun was educated in Rome, and that's very much of what we have. And in that sense, the terrorist war is the first time you ever find the underbelly. If you really look at what happened to Western civilization post 9/11, then you have not happened to what
I think that the
Romans had a good word for exactly what you're talking, parasite, the parasitic culture. Ottomans were parasitic. The Ottomans built the arsenal of Constantinople at Istanbul, exactly copied the one at Venice, copied everything. The man who tore down Constantinople was a German engineer who built a bronze cannon. So that's part of this question is Westernization. Can countries that are not Western and employ Western goods and services, technology, internet, cell phones, and then as a parasitic adversary destroy us in the long run? I don't think they can. Because I think that military efficacy is more than just technology. That even China, until it liberalizes, until a society becomes completely liberal and allows these other notions of what constitutes military organization, discipline, individualism, civic audit, then it never quite reaches the Western degree of prowess. So I'm not impressed with our enemies as far as in military sense. I think that anybody has said on 9/11, within a year and a half, you will have arrested 3,000 of these people. You will have flattened them in Afghanistan. You will remove the Taliban. You don't care about the Arab street, and you're just about ready to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They wouldn't believe you. And that's, I mean, and I think we could have acted much more quickly.
Anybody told you that you have one attack and then you
didn't
enter it, they're building it in Philadelphia, you have to show your ID.
Absolutely. Or I thought you'd have a revolution doing what we do on airlines. So the West has always been, I find it very reactive and ingenious in the way that it makes war and prevents war.
Let me contend that last throwaway line. The revolution might come if we ask passengers, who are you, where are you coming from, where are you going to, why are you traveling? They're not doing that. It's just a slightly more enhanced search for weaponry. It is very...
I think I would agree with you, but we're getting there. I was on a flight not long ago, and somebody from the Middle East came on. And while the government's not profiling him, I'm afraid to say this, the man next to me said, I don't know about you, but if I hear one peep, I'm on that guy. And he said it so loud that everybody in the plane, and I didn't see anybody complain to the stewardess that he was politically incorrect. So I think the mood is changing, and it's going to be hard.
Some people compare Islam, Islamism, to another ism, like fascism, Nazism. The way we defeated those was to destroy the total country. There are still fascist states in the world, there are still communist states in the world, but they're no other threat. They're not a threat anymore. The two parts to my question is, who do you think the totem country is? I have my own ideas. And do you think that should be the next monolithic list? And if we do defeat that, will that change the whole board?
I agree with you. I get so frustrated reading these commentators who say, we'll never win this because there's millions of them. Well, 1939, there was literally hundreds of millions of fascists. Patton said when he took the Third Army into Germany, he said, give them two shots with 77 millimeter, and then they can take down the picture and turn it sideways of Hitler and bring out the flag. And they did. And he said, sometimes you shell it three times to a German village. So his point was, he really didn't care what they said. All he cared is how they acted. And it reminds me of Sherman when he went into Georgia. They said, you're going to end up like Napoleon in Russia. And he said, I don't think so. And he went right to the plantation. And the first plantation owner, Al Cobb's wife, came out and said, go over to the Carolinas. They started it. And that's the attitude. I agree with you entirely that if you made it, we have sent, I think, a powerful message with the Taliban. I think we should have acted much sooner with Iraq. I think it was a great mistake to wait this long, but nevertheless, better late than never. And I think it's going to send a powerful message to remove him. And then it's going to be very interesting because I think that the Iranian government, which I think is in the Bekaa Valley, and these people are going to, they're going to have a peace offensive like we haven't seen. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I think that each time it's incremental, and it's like a weight, and you get the preponderance of weight on your side, and nobody wants to be
as Bin Laden says, with a weak horse. So yeah, I agree entirely. We're, most people, I think, today in the Arab street, hearts and minds, they like Osama Bin Laden, maybe better than George Bush, but it doesn't mean they will in a year from now.
What do you think the total country is?
Well, Daniel can answer that better than I, but I think Iraq is absolutely involved in it. I think Syria is involved in it, and I think Iran is, those three.
Yeah, your idea, when you mentioned Israel, and you mentioned that not reacting to Scuds and other have conveyed an impression that Israel is not willing to fight, that it's a new generation of Israelis. If we link that up to our own situation that led up to 9/11, we've seen, certainly during the 90s with the Oslo process, and even nowadays, in spite of public statements, a tremendous pressure on Israel to make concessions to people who are very much like the people we are fighting. What you asked about the token country. In many ways, Israel has a token country a couple of hundred feet from downtown Jerusalem. And yet the United States sits on Israel. I mean, it keeps telling Israel we must destroy Yasser Arafat as he's the last hope of the peace process. How much is what the Arabs could see both as the American betrayal of a friend and as a Western power's weakness on its right on the front lines? Does that convey a message of a bad message about our results?
It does, and I'm worried, as you are, but polls that I look at, and as somebody who never met anybody who's Jewish, who came from a lot of family can have until I was 18, I do frequent those circles. And believe me, across the United States, talking to people reflects the general polls that about 65% of Americans have unwavering support. Now, I also look at what our enemies say in Europe. And every time I go to Europe, the first issue is that I just talked to the British naval attaché. What is wrong with you people? You just have an insane support of Israel. And that to me, is a good sign. why we do that, I don't know. I can't answer that question. It's not logical that Lebanon swallows the entire... I mean, Syria swallows all of Lebanon. Nobody, that's occupied. Nobody says a word on this.
Russia destroys one of the biggest Muslim cities that's ever been destroyed. Grozny, 200,000, 300,000 people dead in Chechnya. And they're talking about peace. But if I were to be blunt with you, there's about four reasons that explain this inexplicable attitude toward Israel. One is simply fear of terrorism, especially in Europe, fear of Muslim population. The oil takeaway, if you put Saudi Arabia's oil reserves in Israel, and Israel's no reserves in Saudi Arabia, Europe would have a different tune, I think. There's anti-Semitism. I see it all over Europe, no doubt about it. And all of that explains this nightmarish scenario we're in. I just as a cast-off line, I wrote something about this week. History, you know, when that famous quote by Marx about Louis Napoleon who came in 1851 and said that the first Napoleon was tragic and this guy's farce. Well, this is the 30s all over again, only it's farce. You've got this flabby little enteric disease as a poorly scripted Ribbentrop going right to the Vatican, not taking a question from a Jew. Reminds me right of the 30s again. And then you've got Joschka Fischer, whose background reads like Brown Shirt Light or old the cabarets of old Berlin. And you've got Schroeder, who's talking to these mass audiences as a nationalist and as a socialist, and we know what that means. And you've got Jimmy Carter running all around the world as if he's Herbert Hoover. But Herbert Hoover, at least as a president emeritus, had some principles in his charity work. He didn't try to connive to get a Nobel Prize. So it's almost as if all these things are happening, but in a very bastardized, pathetic reincarnation. I'm worried about exactly what you mentioned.
But Dr. Hatzman, getting back to your debate on NPR, do you, and this is part of the same different side of the same question. Do you think we've reached the same point in Roman history where we no longer care about our own culture, no longer believe in it? How close are we to that?
I think we are close. I wrote a couple books in another life about farming, because I am also a farmer. That was one of the values of farming, that it inculcated hard work, and you were around nature and animals, and you saw death and destruction and inexplicable ruin that man couldn't control. Now that you got a humility, and we've lost that. I'm very worried about it. Looking at, I never thought I'd be alive. I went to UC Santa Cruz when it first opened, and after I graduated, I told my late mother, I'll never have to see that again. And then I saw this DC protest with Bomb Texas and these signs, and the same people, it's almost like they came out of central casting, are back again. And I'm very depressed. I'm depressed because it's almost like a religion. It's anti-empirical. I do this with WBTU in Boston about every 3 months, where I debate this Jack Beatty, who's at Atlantic City. And it's almost as if he's a parrot. Afghanistan, well, we're going to lose there. It's just going to be quagmire, and then we come in after that. I said, are you at least going to apologize to people? No, no, it's still worse than the Taliban. And each incident doesn't matter, because the theoretical, anti-empirical, deductive view of the universe is impervious to evidence. And where does that come from? What does it mean? I think it means that there's a lot of people in this country who have very strange ideas because of their affluence, because of their education, because of their intellectual material arrogance about the way the world works. And they don't understand how rare this country is. So I'm very worried about it. I think Daniel is too. That was the point of what he meant by Americans not acknowledging that we're in war. It's the same.
Well, you talked to us about how we ought to confront our adversaries. And what my question to you is, do you have any suggestions on how this country ought to deal with our supposed friends in Europe? Same approach?
It's going to be hard. I wrote two articles in commentary. One was called Goodbye Europe about 6 months ago, and the other was Our Enemies, the Saudis, over a year ago. And I'm still getting letters about that. But from people in the New York Washington nexus who caricature and say, oh, you're just a hick, you don't understand the sophisticated nature of these relationships. But something's happened with Europe. Brussels is only 12 miles from Waterloo. It's like the dream of this united Europe is this man, Billy Pian, the guy at the UN with the pompadour hair. Well, he's the author of The 100 Days, the dream of Napoleon, what could have happened if Napoleon had just won. There's something going on in Europe, this utopian, it's anti-democratic, it's just give us control and we can eliminate all man's pathologies. We always know in the 20th century where that leads to. And when you go there, it's very scary, because it, as its mantle, it's taken this character of the United States, which is more religious, which has real military power, which they don't. A lot of people have made this Kagan-esque argument that because they have no military power, they invest themselves socially and psychically in these international bankrupt bodies, or something to that, too. I don't know what to tell you, but it seems to me, I had talked with some people in the government, and I was going to think that I would be radical in suggesting some things, like take 2,000 to 3,000 troops each year out of Germany, and next time the Greeks say, close down the base in Suda Bay, Crete, say, promises, sure, we'll close it down. And they were way beyond what I was thinking. So I think this is the most revolutionary government we've had in the history of the United States, because they are looking at 50 years of status quo, and they're coming up with a very, I think, empirical smart idea, and that is that we've got this teenager syndrome where you tell your 18-year-old, go to the mall, take the car. She says, I'm going to go to the mall. It's my car. I can do what I want. And she calls you up at midnight and says, the car's dead. Come and get me. And that's sort of this unequal paternalistic relationship that's not healthy for us or them. And the old idea of we got to be in, the Russians out, Germany down, doesn't apply anymore, it seems to me. So I think we're going to see more changes in the next 4 years than we've seen in the last 50. 9/11 was a scab that just tore it off, and underneath there was this big wound. Some of us had been writing for 5 years that take a look at what Europe says about the United States, and nobody believed it. I know, same thing with the Middle East. It's
would the American Civil War fit into your paradigm of a total defeat? After the Civil War in 1864, the idea of secession, especially armed secession, was totally eradicated from the American thinking. And two, slavery as an ideology or thought was totally eradicated. Absolutely nobody supports that idea. Prior to 1864.
Yeah, I wrote a book about that called The Soul Battle, where the third part was the career of General Sherman and how he dealt with some of the scariest rhetoric you'll ever hear from men like Wade Hampton. Especially Nathan Bedford Forrest. And Sherman held a conference with New York reporters and said, Nathan Bedford Forrest has all of Tennessee. We can't stop him. And you know what Sherman said? He said, well, he's one of 300,000 Cavaliers that have to die. And everybody was just aghast. But the fact was, a year later, when there was, after Joe Johnston surrendered in the second surrender, Nathan Forrest told everybody, his 1,500 of his men, he said, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going home. And he did. And he founded the Ku Klux Klan, and he threatened all this. But the fact is, he knew he was beaten, and he knew that the next time he tried that, he was going to be beaten. And it's absolutely right. You have to teach the enemy that they're beaten, or they won't get the message. Everybody wants to character Ariel Sharon about his past, this and that, but it seems to me he has one mission at the end of his life, and that is he has to reestablish deterrence. And he has to reestablish the fact that if you want to go up and blow a bunch of little kids up in Israel, that the retribution is going to be so terrible that you're not going to think about it. I hate to say it, but it seems to me that's his mission in life, and it's a good one.
You mentioned
the West Bank war is over a symbol.
What would you say that symbol is, and how does this idea of deterrence fit in with that?
The West Bank, here you have this country that 40% uninhabited, and you plop down this westernized culture, and in 50 years, you've got brain surgery in Tel Aviv, and you've got Arabs trying to get into Israel rather than Lebanon or Jordan. So right there you have a paradox, that the country that you despise is the country you want to work in, the country you'd rather have heart surgery in, the country that's stronger militarily, that doesn't make any sense. So you try to, then you couple that with the failure of all of these regimes to deal with a soaring birth rate, declining economy, legions of unemployed, and then you add a state-controlled media, and you just say the Jews did it and the Americans did it. So it's, I think the Europeans hate Israel too, because it's an overdog symbol that they're guilty about colonialism, and then suddenly this thing's plopped right down there, and it just flourishes and it works, and it's a civil, humane society, and worse, Arabs want to go to it. That's the worst part about it. So the West Bank then becomes this, has to find something wrong with it. You have to find some culpability, and the West Bank has become that. So you tell people, as I said with this attaché, I said, what was wars 47, 56, 67 about? The West Bank. I said, it wasn't about the West Bank. They didn't have the West Bank. And I said, Bill, what do you think they do if they have another war and they could defeat Israel? And you know what he said to me? Well, they might destroy Israel. But I really believe that most people wouldn't care. I don't think he cares. So the West Bank is a symbol of Westernism. It's a symbol of the overdog. It's a symbol of power. It's a symbol of guilt, envy, jealousy. All of those put together. If the West Bank wasn't there, you'd have to invent it.
Mm-hmm. Last question.
Thank you. I worry a lot about the idea of America, because we can't win anymore. We have the idea of ideal. American exceptionalism. I wonder if you could pick up the thread of other writings of yours about the university. You know, I hear Bonfire of the Humanities, what's happened there with regard to politically correct thinking, multiculturalism, moral relativism that have permeated our society. I think part of the softness we see is trickled down from university through secondary primary education.
Let me try to... Everybody understands the question is, why do a lot of these ideas that we've alluded to that we find scary seem to center in the university? One is the structural. There's no doubt about it. Anytime you give people lifetime employment and affluence and 9 months off, you wouldn't allow that in your law firm because it causes problems. You couple that with the enormous expansion of the university. It's like taking the NBA and expanding it to 500 teams tomorrow. You wouldn't have that many good basketball players in America. Well, we expanded the university in the 60s and 70s, and then we tenured just a whole generation of mediocrities. Second thing is the role of the university after Vietnam was changed, where the role of the university no longer after Vietnam was to have disinterested learning and teach somebody the techniques of dialectic and to approach intellectual problems, but to come up with a preconceived answer to society's problems. That's the second thing. So people see the university, not only are they mediocre and they're tenured for life, but they see the university as a means to correct social problems. Then the third, and this will be a little bit eccentric, but if somebody lives in Central California in a mixed-race family, I really do believe that a lot of the multiculturalism is championed from what I've seen it taught at Stanford Naval Academy. I see it there. I see it in a lot of the universities, Cal State. It's a lot of very affluent, mostly white suburban people who have some inner need to do something that does not allow them or does not permit them or they don't want to meet real minorities, have their daughter go out with a black kid, live next to a Mexican family, work side by side. So this multiculturalism has become boutique multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. It's a way you go in the department lounge, you say, I think we need more Chicanos in the Department of History. And then you go back to your segregated neighborhood and you think, I feel so good about myself. So long as the guy who cuts my lawn is Mexican and not the guy who takes my daughter out tonight. So there's some strange thing about that as well that champions it. And then the final thing is intellectual, and that is there was a great confusion between multiracialism and multiculturalism. The United States, like ancient Greece, and indeed the Western tradition, was the only tradition that did not define itself by the way people looked. So today, if you and I wanted to go to China, we'd never be accepted as Chinese citizens. But Chinese could come here, same with Mexico, same with the Arab world. We wouldn't make it to Saudi Arabia. So we always had this idea that we were a society of ideas, multiracial society, one idea. And then for a variety of reasons, because of differences in immigration, differences, post-colonial ideas, that was lost, and we thought that the way to solve these social problems on the cheap, rather than assimilating people quite brutally as we've done in the past, we would do it less brutally by letting them have their own cultures, because no culture was any better than the other. That's what we didn't believe that, we didn't live that, but that's what we told them. The people who really paid for it, from my experience, are minorities. Because nothing's worse, believe me, to teach a class like I have to do and have trying to teach somebody Latin or Greek and a girl raise her hand and say, as a Chicana, I just want to tell you that I don't enjoy this because it's not my people. And you have to say, shut up and sit down and speak English as a Chicana. Or you have to say, as a white person, I don't like that. So that is where we are in the university. And the only way to correct it is for all of us to very politely speak the truth and challenge it wherever you see it. That's a thankless task.
Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you all very much. It's been a wonderful program.
Thank you.
Thank you.